Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in 1 Kings chapter 11. I'm going to do all 43 verses of this chapter, which I will entitle Solomon's Wives, Adversaries, and Death. Our context is this. In the previous chapter, chapter 10, we see a long recitation of Solomon's wealth and his wisdom. That chapter contained the visit of the Queen of Sheba, who was impressed by Solomon's wealth and wisdom. That was the good news in chapter 10. Now we turn to the bad news in chapter 11. His foreign wives, his enemies, and ultimately his death. So we start now in verses 1 through 6. King Solomon, however, loved many foreign women besides Pharaoh's daughter. Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, and Hittites. They were from nations about which the Lord had told the Israelites, "You must not intermarry with them, because they will surely turn your hearts after their gods." Nevertheless, Solomon held fast to them in love. He had 700 wives of royal birth and 300 concubines, and his wives led him astray. As Solomon grew old, his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not fully devoted to the Lord his God, as the heart of David his father had been. He followed Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. So Solomon did evil in the eyes of the Lord. He did not follow the Lord completely, as David his father had done. All right, verse 1 starts out with this. King Solomon, however, that however is to show a contrast with Solomon's wisdom and prosperity, which had been exhibited in the previous chapter, chapter 10. However, he loved many foreign women. Why did he do that? Why did he have 700 wives and 300 concubines? I mean, you would think that one wife would be enough. Well, here's some possible reasons. John Gill suggests lust. He was a horn dog. Well, I don't think so. I suspect Solomon didn't have intercourse with a tenth of all those 1,000 wives. He wouldn't have the time or the stamina. Just 100 wives, can you imagine? My gosh. The real reason, of course, is political reasons. The more concubines and wives a king had, the more power he had. Also, if you had concubines from foreign countries, which Solomon did, he would get political intelligence from those foreign countries because the wives would talk about what was going on at the royal courts in the foreign countries. Also, of course, you would take a concubine or a wife to form a diplomatic alliance. I'll marry your daughter, I'll marry your niece, if you want to attack me or if you'll help me attack some other country. Another reason why a king would have a lot of concubines is that he would use them as hostages for the good conduct of their fathers or their female or their male relatives. For example, if you wanted to have an alliance with Ammon, you take Ammon's daughter into your concubine, and then you tell the king of Ammon, "All right, you screw me. I'm going to take it out on your daughter, and you'll never see her again." So lots of reasons to have concubines besides lust. But Adam Clark comes against that. He says, well, wait a minute. There's a lot of reasons for state that I've just mentioned. But if we say that's the main reason why Solomon had all those wives, how do we explain this little phrase in verse 2? Solomon held fast to them in love. Well, doesn't that sound romantic? I can just see the chocolates and the valentines that Solomon gave to all of his wives. I don't think that Clark's comment here is apropos. I just think that's sort of a stylized reference. He loved them in an abstract sense. He had them formally as wives, and that's what it meant in love. I don't think it meant romantically in love. I could be wrong, but at any rate, he had all these wives, and for whatever reason he had them, we do know what the result was. They led his heart astray, as it says in verse 3. Now, Solomon loved many foreign women in verse 1 besides Pharaoh's daughter. Well, who was this Pharaoh's daughter? We've mentioned her in a previous episode. Solomon married her and then built her a palace. If you recall, in chapter 7, first 12 verses, we talked about the palace, and there was one chamber there, or one building for the Pharaoh's daughter, and she was eventually moved up from the city of David where she was staying in David's house, and then she was moved up into her own palace up north of the Millo there, up toward Mount Moriah. So this is the same Pharaoh's daughter we're talking about here. Now, it's interesting. There's no mention anywhere of Egyptian gods in Israel. There was mention of Ammonite gods, Moabite gods, Ashtarte, Chemosh. All these pagan idols did not come from Egypt. And so some people have taken that and speculated that Pharaoh's daughter did not turn Solomon's heart away because Solomon never put up Egyptian gods. Some people speculate that, in fact, Pharaoh's daughter may have been a proselyte to the Jewish religion. Well, who knows? Why was Solomon not supposed to marry all these foreign wives? Well, it was prohibited in the law, Deuteronomy 7:1. When the Lord your God shall bring you into the land where you are entering to possess it, you shall clear away many nations before you, the Hittites and the Girgashites and the Amorites and the Canaanites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, seven nations greater and stronger than you. Dropping down to Deuteronomy 7:3, furthermore, you shall not intermarry with them. You shall not give your daughters to their sons, nor shall you take their daughters for your sons. Now, there's something about the male human nature. I remember listening to this guy who came by to give a little talk to my little gathering in Beijing, underground church there in Beijing. I remember him well because he said he was good friends with Max Licato, the famous author. I think he even encouraged Licato to write. I don't remember. But the guy was quite interesting to listen to, and he made a statement that I had never thought about before. He said, the trouble with men is they'll do anything to please their women, their wives, their girlfriends, whatever. And he mentioned Adam. What did he do? Well, he destroyed the whole human race to please his wife Eve. Men like to please their wives, and Solomon liked to please his wives, and his wives were idolaters. So, it's a bad combination. Now, the text mentions that Solomon had 700 wives. That's much more than Solomon mentioned in the Song of Solomon. Song of Songs 6, verse 8. There are 60 queens and 80 concubines and maidens without number. Well, the maidens without number could have been the rest of the 1,000 besides the 60 queens and 80 concubines. And those maidens without number very well could have been the women that Solomon never had sex with. All this is speculation. He had a ton of foreign wives. And he started slipping into apostasy when he was old, it says in verse 4. John Gill says his wives took advantage of Solomon's old age to turn his heart. I don't think that's an excuse. He just got old, rich, everything's going good, and he backslid. He wanted the blandishments of his wives were closer to his ears than the word of God was. Jameson, Fossum, and Brown speculate that when he was old, Solomon couldn't have been more than 50. I don't know how he calculates that, but it doesn't matter. Solomon has no excuse for listening to his wives. Now, some of the gods that he worshipped, that he put idols in Israel of, one of whom is mentioned is in verse 5, Ashtoreth, also known as Astarte. The Encyclopedia Britannica says that she was, quote, goddess of the ancient Middle East and chief deity of the Mediterranean seaports of Tyre, Sidon, and Eilat. Now, how is Eilat a Mediterranean seaport? I don't know. Doesn't matter. Up present-day Lebanon, Astarte was big. She shared many qualities and perhaps a common origin with her sister Anath, the goddess of love and war. Astarte was worshipped in Egypt and in Canaan, as well as among the Hittites. Her Akkadian counterpart was Ishtar. She is often mentioned in the Bible under the name Ashtaroth. And I might add, in the New Testament, that's where we get the name Easter from, as in Astarte eggs or Easter eggs. That's King James translation. Solomon is said to have worshipped the goddess, and Josiah destroyed the shrines dedicated to her. In Egypt, she was assimilated with Isis and Hathor. In the Greco-Roman world, she was assimilated with Aphrodite, the goddess of lust, Artemis, the hunter god, and Juno, Zeus's wife. So she was a big, big goddess, and Solomon kept her cult alive by putting statues or wooden poles or whatever they did. He followed her, it says. Doesn't say he actually put idols up, but we know he must have done that. Molech is mentioned in verse 5 as another one of Solomon's idols. Here's what the Columbia Electronic Encyclopedia has to say about that. Molech, or sometimes spelled Moloch, M-O-L-O-C-H, the Canaanite god of fire to whom children were offered in sacrifice. He is also known as an Assyrian god. All these gods were all over the ancient Near East. He's famous for the child sacrifice. He is attested as early as the 3rd millennium B.C., although most known references to him come from the later period represented by the Hebrew Bible, according to which Solomon, and later Ahaz, introduced the worship of him into Judah. He had a sanctuary at Tophet in the Valley of Hinnom, south of Jerusalem. Milcom may be identifiable with Molech. Milcom is another word that's used in the scripture. So, Molech was a god who made children pass through the fire Some people say that just means they offered the baby up and moved him over the fire that was built in his belly somewhere. They didn't actually kill the kids. I don't believe that. I believe they sacrificed the children, just like abortionists do today in America and in the West and in China, all over the world. Now, in verse 6, it says that Solomon did not follow the Lord completely as David his father had done. Well, the first thing that comes to your mind when you read something like this, wait a minute, what about his adultery with Bathsheba and the murder of Bathsheba's husband, Uriah the Hittite? Well, he's talking about idolatry here. David followed the Lord completely as far as not putting any other idols before God. He didn't do what Solomon did. You have to look at the context. That's what the text means by saying that David followed the Lord completely. As far as idolatry was concerned, he did. We go now to verses 7 through 10 of 1 Kings 11. On a hill east of Jerusalem, Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the detestable god of Moab, and for Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. He did the same for all his foreign wives, who burned incense and offered sacrifices to their gods. The Lord became angry with Solomon because his heart had turned away from the Lord, the God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice. Although he had forbidden Solomon to follow other gods, Solomon did not keep the Lord's command. Now this hill east of Jerusalem, John Gill and Adam Clark say it was the Mount of Olives, which I suspect it was. If it was, think about that. That's the same place Jesus is going to ascend to heaven from. Solomon polluted that place with these stinking idols. So on probably the Mount of Olives, he builds a high place, a place of sacrifice for the Chemosh, the detestable god of Moab, and also Molech. He was the main god of the Ammonites. And then in verse 8, he did the same for all his foreign wives. Having built two altars up there, he could hardly refuse the rest of them, could he? And so he just sank further and further into idolatry. He burned incense and offered sacrifices to their gods. Burning incense is a very typical way of offering homage to a god. The Romans used to force Christians to show their allegiance to the Roman state because they'd say, you need to pinch your incense, pinch it over the fire and offer your incense to the emperor, and then we'll give you the little libellum, the little piece of paper saying that you are a good pagan and good standing incense. The Buddhists today burn incense all over China. I remember going into a Buddhist temple one time, and my host, a man who was a Buddhist, gave me a stick to burn, and I had to explain to him, I ain't going to do that, my friend. I'm not going to burn. I'm a Christian. I'm not going to burn incense to the Buddha. So that's been around for millennia, burning incense to pagan gods. Now notice these wives who are influencing Solomon to do this. Notice how much influence they had over Solomon. They had no political power. They had no family power, and yet they turned a whole nation away from God. Women have lots of power. And again, it's because of what that gentleman said, that men want to please their women. And so women have a lot of power. Think about Catherine de Medici. She was the mother of three kings of France. She was the wife of Henry II of France in the mid-16th century. She basically ruled the country when her husband died, or when her husband was out of the country fighting a war. She was regent and ruled the country. She had a huge power, but she had no political power. I mean, no formal political power. You could say the same thing of Marguerite, the sister of the sister of Francis I, and who married a king in Navarre. You could say the same thing about Diana Poitier, who was the mistress of Henry II of France. You could say the same thing about Eleanor of Aquitaine, who was the wife of Henry II of England, one of the richest and most powerful women in Europe, or most powerful people in Europe. Lots of women who do not have legal power because they can't be king, they still have lots and lots and lots of practical power. Now let's make an application point about marrying a bunch of foreign wives. You might have heard of the practice of missionary dating or missionary marriage. Oh, I'm going to date him. I'm going to lead him to the Lord. Folks, that is the dumbest thing I have ever heard a Christian say. And I've heard a lot of dumb things that Christians have said, but this one takes the cake. It takes the prize for stupidity. And you might show me one case where it worked out. And I'm sure there is. I think I've actually heard of one. I've heard of people having non-Christian boyfriends, but then refusing to marry them until they got saved. Now that's dangerous, but I know one very successful marriage in Beijing that worked out. But I'm telling you, as a general rule, you marry a non-Christian wife, gentlemen, you are making the worst mistake of your life. And I give you as exhibit A, King Solomon. Now in verse 9, the wise are said to have turned Solomon's heart away from the Lord. Some argue that Solomon only did the idolatry in form only. He just went through the motions, but his heart was still on Yahweh. He did that to please his wives, but he didn't really mean it when he was burning the incense to the pagan gods. Well, if that's true, then he's guilty of hypocrisy. What's worse, a hypocritical idolater or a true idolater? That's splitting some fine hairs there. Not to mention the bad example he set to the nation. Well, I don't really believe in these idols. I worship Yahweh secretly at home. But he's a public figure. He's a king. What's the rest of the nation going to think? And besides, the scripture, the text here in verse 9 says that the wives turned his heart away. That makes it sound like Solomon was committing true adultery. He was not just a hypocrite about it. Now in verse 9, the text mentions that the God of Israel had appeared to Solomon twice. That's just to drive home the horrible contrast with a man whose heart had been turned away from the Lord. How much worse is that because God had personally appeared to him in a dream at night, if you recall, twice. Let's look at those two times. The first occasion was at Gibeon, and on both of these occasions, Solomon was warned not to do idolatry. 1 Kings 3:5 at Gibeon, "In Gibeon the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream at night, and God said, 'Ask what you wish me to give you.'" Now at that first occasion at Gibeon, we drop down to verse 14 of 1 Kings 3, we see that Solomon is warned not to do idolatry. 1 Kings 3:14 at Gibeon, "If you walk in my ways and keep my statutes and commands just as your father did, I will give you a long life." In other words, follow me and good things will happen, but he didn't do it. It doesn't mention idolatry specifically, but it just says keep my statutes, one of which is you shall have no other gods before me. So he didn't do it. Well, that was before the temple was built. After the temple was built and dedicated the very next night, the Lord appeared to Solomon a second time. That's in 1 Kings 9, verse 2. The Lord appeared to Solomon a second time as he had appeared to him at Gibeon. Now, in that second time, we read what God said to Solomon in that dream. "Then I, God, will establish the throne of your kingdom over Israel forever, just as I promised to your father David, saying, 'You shall not lack a man on the throne of Israel.' But if you or your son shall indeed turn away from following me and shall not keep my commandments and my statutes, which I have set before you, and shall go and serve other gods and worship them," there he is specific. He explicitly says, if you do this, if you serve other gods and worship them, verse 7, "then I will cut off Israel from the land which I have given them, and the house which I have consecrated for my name," that would be the house of David, "I will cast out of my sight." That happened 586 B.C. The Babylonians came in and wiped them out. So Israel will become a proverb and a byword among all peoples today. Two millennia later, we're still talking about that Babylonian exile and destruction of Jerusalem. So Solomon was warned. He did it anyway. The great wise Solomon. He wasn't wise. He was a doomkopf. We go down to 1 Kings 11, verses 11 through 13. "So the Lord said to Solomon, 'Since this is your attitude, and you have not kept my covenant and my decrees, which I commanded you, I will most certainly tear the kingdom away from you and give it to one of your subordinates. Nevertheless, for the sake of David your father, I will not do it during your lifetime. I will tear it out of the hand of your son. Yet I will not tear the whole kingdom from him, but will give him one tribe for the sake of David my servant and for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen.'" Now in verse 11, the Lord speaks to Solomon. The Lord said to Solomon, that's probably through Ahijah the prophet, who we will introduce in just a minute. Gil Clark and all the Jewish rabbis say that's who said it, and I believe that's probably true. "Since Solomon, you've done all this idolatry, I will tear the kingdom away from you, give it to one of your subordinates." That would be Jeroboam, who was working in Solomon's kingdom at this time. We'll introduce him in just a minute too. Verse 12, "Nevertheless, for the sake of David your father," not because of David's merits, but because of God's promise to him through Nathan the prophet in the very famous prophecy in 2 Samuel 12 through 13. "When your time comes and you rest with your fathers," God is speaking to David through Nathan, "I, Yahweh, will raise up after you your descendant," that would be Solomon, "who will come from your body," that will be Solomon, "and I will establish his kingdom," establish Solomon's kingdom. "He will build a house for my name." Literally speaking, that would be the temple, but of course, ultimately, it was the progeny of David, who were fulfilled in the Church of Christ. "Solomon will build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever." Well, if God had totally destroyed the southern kingdom, the tribe of Judah, because of Solomon's idolatry, that would have messed up his prophecy that he had given to David through Nathan. So for the sake of David, in other words, because of what I've already promised David, I'm not going to completely destroy you. I'm going to give you another tribe. So in other words, this tearing away of the kingdom is not going to happen during Solomon's lifetime. I'm going to tear it out of the hand of your son. That would be Rehoboam. He ended up with only one tribe. Well, he ended up with his tribe, Judah, plus another tribe, Benjamin. Well, let's look at that phrase, one tribe. In verse 13, God says to Solomon, through Ahijah the prophet, "Yet I will not tear the whole kingdom from him," from Solomon, from Rehoboam, excuse me, Solomon's son. "I will not tear the whole kingdom from Rehoboam, but will give him one tribe." Well, there's a problem here. The southern kingdom had two tribes, Judah and Benjamin. Here's some options to reconcile that. Rehoboam already had one tribe, his own tribe of Judah, and God gave him one more tribe, Benjamin, and I think that's the easiest way to reconcile it. Another way is to say, well, Jeroboam had certain towns in Benjamin. Remember, Rehoboam and Jeroboam are going to split. Jeroboam's going to take the northern 10 tribes, and Rehoboam's going to take the southern 2 tribes right after Solomon dies. And so Jeroboam had certain towns in Benjamin, which was Rehoboam's tribe. So we could say that Rehoboam really only has complete possession of Judah. I think that's a stretch. Here's another way to look at this one tribe problem. Judah and Benjamin were so closely intermingled, they were considered as one tribe. They both actually had possession of Jerusalem. The dividing line went right through the middle of the city. And so when Ahijah tells Solomon, "I'm going to give your son one tribe," what he means is Judah and Benjamin considered as one tribe. I don't think that's right. I think it's easier to say, "I'm going to give you another tribe. You already got your own, Rehoboam. That's Judah. I'm going to give you another tribe, Benjamin." For the sake of David, and for the sake of Jerusalem, actually it would be the sake of the temple which was in Jerusalem that Solomon had built, I'm not going to let it be destroyed. I'm just going to rip the kingdom apart, but you're still going to hang on to a remnant. And that just shows a lot of God's punishments are modulated. Even in our personal lives, we do a lot of terrible things, and you could go to jail. I mean, I could be in jail, I mean, easily, when I think of the dumb stuff I did as a kid, but I didn't get sent to jail. Through the grace of God, and I repented, and I quit putting smoke bombs in burger restaurants and things like that. But God could have destroyed my life. I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you about the Bible today if justice had been administered fully at the time that I deserved it. We turn now to 1 Kings 11, verses 14 through 18. "Then the Lord raised up against Solomon an adversary, Hadad the Edomite, from the royal line of Edom." Earlier, when David was fighting with Edom, Joab, the commander of the army, who had gone up to bury the dead, had struck down all the men in Edom. Joab and all the Israelites stayed there for 6 months until they had destroyed all the men in Edom. But Hadad, still only a boy, fled to Egypt with some Edomite officials who had served his father. They set out from Midian and went to Paran. Then, taking men from Paran with them, they went to Egypt, to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, who gave Hadad a house and land and provided him with food. Well, we move now from Solomon's wives and his idolatry to his political and military enemies. Of course, there's a reason why he has political and military enemies. It's because of all the idolatry he has committed, so there's a certain logic to the structure of this chapter. That's why it says in verse 14, Yahweh raised up against Solomon, just to show that Solomon was being punished for his idolatry. Even though the kingdom wasn't taken completely from him, but nonetheless, he has to deal with all these military revolts when he was at peace. The first one is the problem that Solomon had with a certain Edomite named Hadad. Verse 15 mentions that earlier David had been fighting with Edom. Edom is an Edomite. Hadad is an Edomite. David was fighting with Edom. We see that in 2 Samuel 8:14, and he, that's David, put garrisons in Edom. And all Edom he put garrisons, and all the Edomites became servants to David, and the Lord helped David wherever he went. So Edom was a subjected country to David, but somehow there was a battle. Maybe that was in the original battle where Joab went to bury the dead, or maybe it was dead Israelites who got surprised in their garrisons and they got killed, and so Joab had to go down there and bury the dead. Or maybe he wanted to bury the dead Edomites. That was a customary honorary thing, to bury the enemy's dead. But at any rate, Joab had gone down there, and it must have been a big deal because it's recorded here. He struck down all the men in Edom. Again, that all does not mean all exhaustively. It means a lot. Sounds like hyperbole, really. There was a ton of people that got killed down there by Joab. It was so bad that Hadad had to flee. Now he fled to Egypt, and the way he did that, Edom runs from the southern end of the Dead Sea to the northern tip of the Gulf of Aqaba, which is the Red Sea. So between the dead and the red, that's where Edom is, along the Arabah Valley there in that area. And Midian is right at the tip of the Gulf of Aqaba, also on the eastern side over there in present-day Jordan, or southern Jordan and northern Saudi Arabia. So that's the general area of Midian, where Moses married Zipporah, if you recall, and Jethro, also known as Reuel, was his father-in-law. That's the Midian. And so that's right south in the southern portion of Edom. So Hadad went down there, and then he took a western turn, went through the desert there. I'm sure he went a little ways until he is now at the northern edge of the Sinai Peninsula, which is where the wilderness of Paran is, P-A-R-A-N. And so once you get used to the map, this is a very logical path for him to take. So he goes across the Sinai desert, which of course belonged to Egypt. He crosses goes north of the Gulf of Suez, and he's into Egypt proper. And wherever the Pharaoh was, the Pharaohs moved their capitals around, of course. Hadad finds the Pharaoh, and Pharaoh gives Hadad a house and a land and gave him some food. We go on now to 1 Kings 11, verses 19 through 22. Pharaoh was so pleased with Hadad that he gave him a sister of his own wife. Not only some food did Pharaoh give Hadad, not only a house, not only some land, but a wife, his sister-in-law. That means a political alliance between Edom, or what's left of Edom, and Pharaoh. His wife was named Queen Tapenes, Tapenes, T-A-H-P-E-N-E-S. So Tapenes' sister goes over to Hadad to get married. Now, this is a typical practice in Egypt. It's also a typical practice all through the Middle Ages and Western history. Happened over. That's all they did, was sit around and figure out who was going to marry whom. As the historians put it, who's going to marry whom in the quote-unquote marriage market? It's a sick system, in my humble opinion. So the sister-in-law, the sister of Tapenes, married Hadad, and Hadad and the sister had a son named Genubath, whom Tapenes the queen raised up in the royal palace. There Genubath lived with Pharaoh's own children. While he was in Egypt, Hadad heard that David rested with his fathers. David had died. And that Joab, the commander of the army, was also dead. Ooh, that's good news. Remember, Solomon took care of him as he held onto the horns of the altar. Then Hadad said to Pharaoh, "Let me go that I may return to my own country." "What have you lacked here that you want to go back to your own country?" Pharaoh asked. "Nothing," Hadad replied, "but do let me go." And of course, why did he want to go? Well, he wants to stir up some revolt in Edom against Solomon. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say this, quote, "Hadad was defeated by the numerous and strong garrisons planted throughout the Edomite territory. Hadad seems to have offered his services to Rezin, another of Solomon's adversaries." As we'll see here in this chapter, verses 23 through 25, it's a speculation. Adam Clark says the reason he wanted to go was this, quote, "It does not appear that he avowed his real intention to Pharaoh, for at this time there must have been peace between Israel and Egypt, Solomon having married the daughter of Pharaoh." So that long alliance with Egypt was shot. Solomon had married Pharaoh's daughter, and now the Pharaoh is openly entering into a marriage alliance with Solomon's enemy, the Edomite, Hadad. We go down to 1 Kings 11, verses 23 through 25. "And God raised up against Solomon another adversary, Rezin, son of Eliada, who had fled from his master, Hadadezer, king of Zobah. He gathered men around him and became the leader of a band of rebels when David destroyed the forces of Zobah. The rebels went to Damascus, where they settled and took control. Rezin was Israel's adversary as long as Solomon lived, adding to the trouble caused by Hadad." So it looks like Hadad and Rezin, as I just said, were hooked up with one another, not to mention that Egypt is now not so friendly with Solomon anymore. "So Rezin ruled in Aram, that's Syria, and was hostile toward Israel." So now Solomon's got an enemy on his northeastern border in Syria. Now let's go back and look at some of the politics of Syria here in the 10th century BC. First of all, the kingdom of Zobah, that is somewhere in the desert there from the Anti-Lebanon Range and the Euphrates River. That's Syria. I don't know exactly where it is, but it was a Syrian kingdom. Columbia Electronic Encyclopedia says of Zobah, It's an Aramean state, Assyrian state, northeast of ancient Palestine. At the time of Saul, David, and Solomon, I've already told you that, it waged war on Israel. An alternate form is Hamath-Zobah. Well, okay, so it's somewhere up there in the north of Israel, northeast of Israel, and it was ruled in verse 23 by a guy named Hadadezer, and Rezon was fighting under Hadadezer and rebelled against Hadadezer and took off. He gathered a bunch of rebels around him. This was after David had beat Hadadezer, king of Zobah. David had beat the forces of Zobah, and so Rezon says, well, my bread's not buttered anymore by Hadadezer, so I'm going to take over. So he gets his rebels, and he goes to Damascus, which of course is right there in Syria, right to the northeast of Israel, and took control of the city of Damascus. And so now Rezon has taken over from Hadadezer. As long as Solomon lived, which was from 970 to 931 that he ruled, Rezon was opposed to Solomon. So now Solomon's got an enemy of Edom to the south. He's got an enemy of Syria, or Zobah, a Syrian kingdom, to the northeast. And to his southwest, Egypt is not happy with him anymore either. So verse 25, Rezon was Israel's adversary as long as Solomon lived, adding to the trouble caused by Hadad. So Solomon is really seeing his political influence sink. So Rezon was Israel's adversary as long as Solomon lived in verse 25, but that, of course, does not refer to Solomon's whole life. It means from the time he committed idolatry to the day that he died. Let's talk a little bit more about Rezon. When David fought with him, this is according to John Gill, Rezon, seeing the battle go against his master Hadadezer, and that he was like to be worsted, deserted him, deserted Hadadezer, and fled. I've already mentioned that. I got the idea from John Gill. We see David defeating Hadadezer in 2 Samuel 8:3. Then David defeated Hadadezer, the son of Rehob, king of Zobah, as he went to restore his rule at the river. That's the river Euphrates. Well, by the fact that Rezon is now fighting Solomon, this shows that God has fulfilled his prophecy given through the prophet Nathan. This is what Adam Clark says, quote, thus God fulfilled his threatening by the prophet Nathan. If he commits iniquity, I will chasten him with the rod of men and with the stripes of the children of men. That's 2 Samuel 7:14. Well, Solomon's being chastened by the rod of men. Now, to add to a little confusion because of these names, remember Hadad was an Edomite. We've already finished talking about him. But this Rezon, when he died, his son was called Hadad. It's a different Hadad. Let me read Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. He, that's Rezon, was succeeded by Hadad, whose successors took the official title of Ben-Hadad. That's the son of Hadad. So we're going to see that name Ben-Hadad show up a lot in the history of the kings. So we might as well get used to it now. So Rezon has Hadad, has a son Hadad, and Hadad has a son called Ben-Hadad, and after that is Ben-Hadad all the way down. So the successors of Rezon, the Ben-Hadads, they were the illustrious, the first Ben-Hadad was the illustrious founder of the powerful kingdom of Damascene, Syria, Damascus. These hostile neighbors, who had been long kept in check by the traditional fame of David's victories, took courage in breaking out towards the latter end of Solomon's reign. They must have not only disturbed his kingdom by their inroads, but greatly crippled his revenue by stopping his lucrative traffic with Tadmor, that's Palmyra, and the Euphrates. Of course, Tadmor is right in the middle between Zobah and the Euphrates River. Damascus is right around that area, too. And there was a big trade route going through there. Tadmor, known later as Palmyra, even to this day is known as Palmyra. That was a great trade emporium, a crossroads of merchants' traffic going from the Far East all the way to the Near East. Now he's got enemies up there. So Solomon's world is shrinking. We go down to 1 Kings 11, verse 26 through 28. Also, that means in addition to all this horrible stuff that's happened to Solomon, it gets even worse because now he's going to have domestic enemies as well as foreign enemies. Verse 26, also Jeroboam, son of Nebat, rebelled against the king. He was one of Solomon's officials, an Ephraimite from Zeredah, and his mother was a widow named Zeruah. Here is the account of how he rebelled against the king. Solomon had built the supporting terraces, that's the Millo, and had filled in the gap in the wall of the city of David, his father. Now Jeroboam was a man of standing, and when Solomon saw how well the young man did his work, he put him in charge of the whole labor force of the house of Joseph. Now, Jeroboam was from Ephraim, which of course is the tribe right to the north of Benjamin. Benjamin, the southern edge of Benjamin, southern boundary went right through Jerusalem. Zerida is somewhere in Ephraim. Nobody knows where. Some people say, well, the BibleAtlas.org says it's the same as Zarathan, which is how it's pronounced, how it's stated in Chronicles. Some people say Zarathan is near Succoth, which of course is across the Jordan River, right near the Jabbok River. Nobody knows. He was up there somewhere. In fact, the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia, ISBE, says nobody knows where it was. But we do know he was from Ephraim. His mother was a widow named Zeruah. That sounds like Zeruiah. Close. David's sister, who had all those generals as sons. She was probably supported by her son, Jeroboam, who was an industrious and ingenious man, as Gil says. Well, that makes sense. Now, he rebelled against Solomon. Some people say he rebelled against Rehoboam because that's who he ended up fighting when they had the civil division of the kingdom, the civil war. No, it's Solomon. He rebelled against the king, I believe. And the background of this, Solomon had built the supporting terraces, the Millo. If you look at the city of David, that long tongue of land that stretches in between the Tarapean valleys to the west and the Kidron Valley to the east and reaches all the way down to the Valley of Hinnom in the south, on the northern end of that tongue of land, there was some kind of earthwork. The scholars don't know exactly what it was. It could be a wall holding up the edge of Mount Moriah. Who knows? It could be steps so you could get up from the city of David up to Mount Moriah. It could be defensive fortifications to keep people out of the city of David if they came from the north. I don't know, but Solomon had built those things and had filled in the gap in the wall of the city. I assume that means that there was a wall across the northern end of the Mount Zion, the city of David. The city of David is Mount Zion. And there was a gap there, and he filled it in for probably defensive purposes, maybe architectural purposes, but he had built that. And as he was building it, he noticed one of his people, one of his officials named Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, and he says, this guy's doing good work. And so Solomon put Jeroboam in charge of the whole labor force of the house of Joseph. The house of Joseph is the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh. Manasseh, of course, is north of the tribe of Ephraim. And so Jeroboam's climbing up in the world. Now, what caused his disaffection? The Jewish rabbis say that Jeroboam reproached Solomon for doing these works, building the terraces, the Millo there. He also built a house in Millo for Pharaoh's daughter. Oh, that's bad, you know. You're lying with those pagans down there in Egypt. That might have got Jeroboam mad. Some rabbis speculate that Solomon has stopped up the passage to the city of David so people couldn't walk from the north down to the south into the Mount Zion because it was blocked up, because that gap in the wall had been blocked up. Well, that's all speculation. The point is Jeroboam's going to rebel. Now, Jeroboam is put in charge of a labor force, a slave labor, folks. Now let's read what Adam Clark says about that. At first it appears that Solomon employed none of the Israelites in any drudgery, but it is likely that as he, Solomon, grew profane, he grew tyrannical and oppressive, and at the works of Millo he changed his conduct, and there in all probability were the seeds of disaffection sown. And Jeroboam, being a clever and enterprising man, knew well how to avail himself of the general discontent. That's a reasonable speculation. Here's what Jameson Foster Brown says about it. Quote, the heavy exactions and compulsory labor which Solomon latterly imposed upon his subjects when his foreign resources began to fail had prepared the greater part of the kingdom for a revolt under so popular a demagogue as Jeroboam. Folks, when kings build great armies and great buildings, they have to tax you to death. And in this case, we don't have slavery anymore, so we just tax people to death now. But back then, they had slavery. And so he was using foreign slaves at first, as I mentioned in the chapters concerning the building of the temple and his palace. He used foreign slaves at first, but now, apparently, he's using Israelites too. Because it says the labor force of the house of Joseph, that's Ephraim and Manasseh. That sounds like native Israelites. And so these commentators so deduce. Now, being in charge of the forced labor in Ephraim and Manasseh might mean that Jeroboam actually became a political governor, a deputy governor of those two provinces, or maybe he was just sent as a tax collector up there to collect the revenues from that part of the country. So he either managed the slaves or he collected money either way. Taking money, taxation is basically government appropriation of your finances, and slavery is government appropriation of your labor. We go now to 1 Kings 11, verses 29 through 36. About that time, Jeroboam was going out of Jerusalem, and Ahijah the prophet of Shiloh met him on the way, wearing a new cloak. The two of them were alone out in the country, and Ahijah took hold of the new cloak he was wearing and tore it into 12 pieces. Then he said to Jeroboam, "Take 10 pieces for yourself, for this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. See, I am going to tear the kingdom out of Solomon's hand and give you 10 tribes. But for the sake of my servant David in the city of Jerusalem, which I have chosen out of all the tribes of Israel, he will have one tribe. I will do this because they have forsaken me and worshipped Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, Chemosh, the god of the Moabites, and Molech, the god of the Ammonites, and have not walked in my ways, nor done what is right in my eyes, nor kept my statutes and laws as David, Solomon's father, did. But I will not take the whole kingdom out of Solomon's hand. I have made him ruler all the days of his life for the sake of David, my servant, whom I chose and who observed my commands and statutes. I will take the kingdom from his son's hands and give you 10 tribes. I will give one tribe to his son, that would be Rehoboam, so that David my servant may always have a lamp before me in Jerusalem, the city where I chose to put my name." So in verse 29, Jeroboam's leaving Jerusalem, going out, probably to take up his new office in Ephraim there, or Manasseh, wherever he was operating from. Or it could be he'd already gone up to Ephraim and Manasseh, collected some taxes, some tribute money, and was had gone down to Jerusalem to pay those revenues to Solomon, then had left Jerusalem and was going back up to Ephraim and Manasseh. While he was going back to Ephraim and Manasseh, a prophet named Ahijah, who was from Shiloh. Shiloh, of course, is Manasseh to the north there where Eli used to operate from. Now, Ahijah is one of those who wrote the history of the reign of Solomon, so he's a prophet worth taking note of. We read that in 2 Chronicles 9:29, which I'll read now. "Now, the rest of the acts of Solomon, from first to last, are they not written in the records of Nathan the prophet, and in the prophecy of Ahijah the Shilonite, and in the visions of Iddo the seer concerning Jeroboam the son of Nebat?" So there's our source, our three sources there: Nathan, the famous prophet of David; Ahijah, the prophet mentioned here; and another guy named Iddo the seer. Now, Ahijah met Jeroboam walking back up to Ephraim and Manasseh, and that was probably on purpose. That was not an accident. He had something he wanted to tell him. When they got alone out there, now that's alone between those two, but there might have been servants, as John Gill says. "It is possible Jeroboam might have some servants with him, but Ahijah, desiring some private conversation with him, he sent the servants onwards, or bid them stay at some distance, who yet might be capable of observing what was done, though not of hearing what was said, or otherwise how should Solomon come to the knowledge of it?" Well, we'll talk about that in a minute, how Solomon might have found out about this secret meeting, because this is treason from a political standpoint. God's prophet Ahijah was committing treason, as well as Jeroboam. Now, Ahijah is said to be wearing a new cloak in verse 29. I don't know why it's interesting or relevant that it was a new cloak as opposed to an old cloak. Perhaps it stood for the kingdom that was getting torn apart. It was a new kingdom. Didn't last very long. I don't know. But Ahijah was wearing that cloak on purpose too, because he wanted to tear it up and use it as an object lesson, as prophets often did. Jameson Fawcett Brown said he was probably using that cloak for secrecy too, because of the treason that he was committing. Now, Ahijah tells Solomon, he's quoting God, and God says this, "But I will not take the whole kingdom out of Solomon's hand. I have made Solomon ruler all the days of Solomon's life for the sake of David." What has David got to do with Solomon being the ruler for the rest of Solomon's life? Well, it was so that Nathan's prophecy to David would still be fulfilled. Remember that famous prophecy in 2 Samuel 7:12-13, "When your time comes and you rest with your fathers, I will raise up after you your descendant who will come from your body." It's talking about Solomon. "And I will establish his kingdom." I will establish Solomon's kingdom. "He will build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever." So that was a promise made to David, and so God's going to keep it, even though he's going to punish Solomon severely for his gross idolatry. This illustrates a pattern in the Old Testament. God can keep his covenant at the same time by punishing his covenant people. He just doesn't punish to the utmost, because if he did that, he would destroy his covenant people. So he keeps his covenant promise alive while meting out severe punishments. Now, in verse 32, we see that phrase, one tribe, again. I've already mentioned this. Ahijah, quoting God, says that Solomon will have one tribe. Rehoboam will have one tribe. How can Rehoboam only have one tribe since the southern kingdom under Rehoboam had two tribes, namely Judah and Benjamin? There were three options to reconcile that. I won't go over them all again, just to cite to you what I think is the best way to explain this. Rehoboam already had one tribe, his own tribe of Judah, and then God gave him one more tribe, which is Benjamin, so he then had a total of two. So then you would read that in verse 32, he, Rehoboam, will have one additional tribe. So in verse 35, God, through Ahijah, promises Jeroboam that the kingdom will be taken from Solomon's sons, Rehoboam's hands, and given to Jeroboam. 10 tribes will be given to Jeroboam. It states that explicitly in verse 35. Well, you would think Jeroboam would be happy with that, but no, he tried to help God along. This is what Jamerson Fawcett and Brown says about Jeroboam. Quote, his aspiring ambition, impatient for the death of Solomon, led him to form plots and conspiracies, in consequence of which he was compelled to flee to Egypt. Though chosen of God, he could not wait for the course of God's providence. How many times has God promised us? Application point here. How many times has God promised us something, and we're going to urge the situation along? We're going to do God's work for him. We're going to work in our flesh so that God can fulfill his promises to us. 1 Kings 11, verses 37 through 43, and we will finish this chapter. However, this is still Ahijah speaking for God to Jeroboam. However, as for you, Jeroboam, I, God, will take you, and you will rule over all that your heart desires. You will be king over Israel. Now, from now on, we'll call Israel the northern 10 tribes, and the southern 2 tribes are called Judah. Verse 38, if you do whatever I command you and walk in my ways and do what is right in my eyes by keeping my statutes and commands, as David my servant did, I will be with you. I will build you a dynasty as enduring as the one I built for David and will give Israel to you. A great promise. But notice the promise had a condition. If you do whatever I command you. And folks, the northern kings of Israel did not do what God commanded them. They did not walk in his ways. And so their dynasty was not as enduring as the one that God built for David. The northern kingdom's dynasty petered out in 722 BC when the Assyrians took over. David's dynasty was destroyed in 586 BC, his temporal dynasty, in 586 BC when the Babylonians destroyed Jerusalem. But God is very gracious to Jeroboam. He lays it out for him. He said, if you do right, you'll be in good shape. But he didn't do right. Verse 39, Ahijah continues speaking for God to Jeroboam. I, Yahweh, will humble David's descendants because of this, but not forever. And of course, that humbling is referring to taking the largest part of the kingdom away from David's descendants. But that humbling in verse 39 will not last forever. Two ways that was fulfilled. Many southern kings reigned in great power and prosperity after 722 BC. So David was not humbled forever. But of course, even beyond that, the Messiah's kingdom will last forever and ever and ever. He will reign forever and ever and ever, as Handel's Messiah says. So David's throne, upon which Jesus sits as the head of his body, the church, so we share in his reign and his rule, as it says over and over again in the book of Revelation. So David's descendants were humbled because of Solomon's sin, but not forever. Verse 40, Solomon tried to kill Jeroboam. Now that's something, because Solomon had already been told by God he was going to lose the kingdom. That was in 1 Kings 11:11, which I will read to you again. So the Lord said to Solomon, since this is your attitude, and you have not kept my covenant and my decrees, which I commanded you, I will most certainly tear the kingdom away from you and give it to one of your subordinates. So this is, again, a prophecy given to Solomon, probably by the same Ahijah. But Solomon had been told, hey, you're going to lose the kingdom, but that doesn't matter. He sees the person who's going to try to take the kingdom from him, and he's probably heard by now the prophecy given to Jeroboam from Ahijah. And so he tries to kill Jeroboam to put a stop to God's prophecy. Well, now that brings up the issue that I mentioned earlier that I was going to bring up. How did Solomon know what Jeroboam was up to? Well, it could be that Ahijah just told everybody about what had happened. It could be that most probably is Jeroboam couldn't keep his mouth shut. I'm going to be king one day, and so he told all of his friends. Or it could be at that meeting between Ahijah and Jeroboam, as Jeroboam was heading back to Ephraim, when Ahijah met him alone out there in the wilderness or in the countryside on the road, maybe his servants were close by and they could figure out what was going on when Ahijah ripped the cloak up into 12 pieces. And of course, the servants would have gone back to Solomon and said, "This is really strange. Jeroboam met Ahijah and Ahijah ripped open his cloak into 12 pieces. What in the world is going on?" Of course, Solomon would easily understand that, especially since in verse 11, Ahijah had already told Solomon that the kingdom was going to be taken away from him. And so Solomon, that great and godly man, tried to kill Jeroboam. I want you to remember that when we get to the end of this chapter and talk about, did Solomon ever get saved? Jeroboam, in verse 40, fled to Egypt because of what Solomon was trying to do to him. He fled to Shishak, the Pharaoh down there. He stayed there until Solomon's death, so he was safe with Shishak. Now, who is this Shishak? Well, he's also known as Shishonk the First. I just love these names, Shishonk. Let me read you what the Columbia Electronic Encyclopedia says about Shishonk the First, or Shishak. He died around 929 and 924. Remember, Solomon died 931, so they were near contemporaries. He was king of ancient Egypt, founder of the 22nd Libyan dynasty. He was a contemporary of Solomon. He offered Jeroboam the first refuge, as we just read. Later, Shishonk, or Shishak, overran Palestine. He enlarged, we're going to see that later. I forgot where it is, but we're going to see Shishak overrunning Palestine later on. Shishak enlarged the temple at Karnak. Now, this temple at Karnak has got the biggest pillars you've ever seen. It's really ugly, monumental, but it's a big, famous temple that has a lot of drawings on the walls, and they get a lot of ancient Near Eastern history from those walls, so it's very famous if you read ancient Near Eastern history. And I was going to see it, and I wanted to see it so bad, but COVID-19 canceled a trip I had planned to Egypt to see it, as well as the other stuff there. But at any rate, Shishak enlarged that temple at Karnak, and on its walls recorded the tribute paid him in Palestine and Nubia, which is south of Egypt. His temple court, fronted by a huge pylon, was the largest ever built. So he's sort of a famous guy. The king's body was found in 1938 and 1939 in his burial chamber at Tanis. So we might not know who the Pharaoh of the Exodus was, but we do know who this Shishak is. Gill says, quote, that Shishak was, quote, either the father-in-law or the brother-in-law of Solomon. In other words, identifying Pharaoh's daughter as being the daughter of Shishak. Or he was one of another family on whom the kingdom devolved and who might not have any good respect for Solomon, and therefore Jeroboam thought himself safe with him. This is the only king of Egypt in Scripture that is called by his own name and not Pharaoh. So now, after all this sordid detail, Solomon's going to die. Before he dies, in verse 41, all the other events of Solomon's reign, are they not written in the book of the Annals of Solomon? Of course, this is one of the source materials that whoever wrote 1st and 2nd Kings, I'm speculating as Jeremiah, he used this, the book of the Annals of Solomon. Who wrote the book of the Annals of Solomon? Well, Solomon himself could have written them. I mean, after all, he was a smart guy. Could have been some chronologer or historiographer that was employed by Solomon, of course. Could have been by several prophets and an editor. 2 Chronicles 9:29, I've already read you this. Now, the rest of the acts of Solomon, for first to last, are they not written in the records of Nathan the prophet, in the prophecy of Ahijah the Shilonite, and in the visions of Iddo? So those three could have written down some of their prophecies, collected in a book called the Books of the Annals of Solomon. Verse 42 says that Solomon ruled for 40 years. And the nice thing about his dates, unlike David's, his dates are ironclad, 970 to 931 B.C. This is Bible Hub timeline, as well as Wikipedia, as well as a lot of other sources, so we can bank on that one. 970 to 931, you might say, well, that's just 39 years. But remember, you can count the beginning and end dates of a date range and come up with 40 with no trouble. So he rested with his fathers. I love that euphemism. You rest with your fathers. You go to the grave just like they did, but it's a restful thing. Now, Gill estimates that when he died was somewhere between 52 and 94. Well, that narrows it down a lot, does it not? But the more interesting question we need to ask here is, did he repent of his sins before he died? Now, nothing anywhere in the Scripture says that he did repent, but John Gill says this, though nothing is said of Solomon's repentance, there is no doubt, but he was a good man, repented of his sins. Well, I'm not so sure about that. Well, here's some evidence that tends to prove that he did repent. First of all, he's commended as a good king after his death, 2 Chronicles 11:17, and they strengthened the kingdom of Judah and supported Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, for 3 years, for they walked in the way of David and Solomon for 3 years. Sounds like he's a good king. Well, just because he's a good king, and he was at the beginning of his reign, that doesn't mean he is eternally saved. I mean, that's sort of a weak argument. Another argument that Solomon was saved comes from this, from the promise of God that God made to him, that God's mercy should not depart from Solomon, although he chastised him. Again, referring to Nathan's famous prophecy to David, 2 Samuel 7:14-15. I will be a father to him, and he will be a son to me when he commits iniquity. This is referring to David's son, Solomon. When he commits iniquity, I will correct him with the rod of men and the strokes of the sons of men. But, verse 15 is key here, but my loving kindness shall not depart from him as I took it away from Saul, whom I removed from before you. Well, God's loving kindness does not depart from him. That could just mean that Solomon's kingdom will not be taken away from him while he's still living. And that happened, but that doesn't mean he went to heaven. It could merely mean that Solomon's temporal kingdom wasn't taken from him. It doesn't have anything to do with eternal life. Here's a third argument that Saul got saved. Well, Solomon. Wasn't Solomon an inspired writer? And weren't all the inspired writers holy men? That's a little stronger argument. Here's the fourth argument in response to a claim that, hey, he wasn't saved. Read the book of Ecclesiastes. All is vanity and striving after the wind. Yeah, well, you could say he wrote that book after his fall. And that's one of my favorite books because it shows the vanity of this world. It's a good book for lawyers, and I used to be a lawyer. But people look at all the bad stuff that happened to Solomon in that book and say, see, there he couldn't be saved. Well, yeah, but, you know, that could just be referring to after his fall, but he could have been saved from beforehand. And besides, in the book of Ecclesiastes, there's a recantation of his sins, repentance for his sins. Well, Gill says he was saved. Let's see what Adam Clark says. Quote, Solomon died in almost the flower of his age, and it appears unregretted. His government was no blessing to Israel, and laid by his exactions and oppressions the foundation of that schism which was so fatal to the unhappy people of Israel and Judah, and was the most powerful procuring cause of the miseries which have fallen upon the Jewish people from that time until now. Well, Clark's not so gung-ho on Solomon, even from a political aspect. That doesn't really mean that he's not saved either. So I just mention all these speculations to say we don't know whether Solomon's saved or not anymore. We know that a lot of people aren't saved or not. It's hard to know. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished 1 Kings chapter 11. We are now prepared to go to our next chapter in the next audio, 1 Kings 12, and we will see the kingdom divided after Solomon dies. Hope you stay tuned for that unhappy event, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.